Thank you for joining us this morning, and now I'm going to turn it over to Dean Tomaselli.
Thank you, Mariana. Thank you for joining us in the next installment of the In Conversation series. Welcome, and I hope everyone is well. We are clearly in the next wave of COVID-19, both in the country and in our region. But I think we're in a different place with now the availability of vaccines, and I'll come back to this in just a moment. We have seen a steady increase in the number of patients who test positive for COVID-19 in our emergency departments, up from about 5% in October to about 20% now. The health system's census of COVID-19 positive patients has increased from below 100 to about 600 now. And these changes really do mirror regional changes in positive test rates and hospitalization rates. But as the result of the work of our guest today and many others, I think we're in a far better position than we were in the spring to deal with not only this surge in the pandemic, but the pandemic in general. There are a number of questions that have come in today. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce our speaker and let him speak on this topic. Dr. Barry Zingman is professor of medicine and infectious diseases. He is the clinical director of infectious disease at the Moses Division of the Montefiore Health System and is the medical director of the AIDS Center at Montefiore and has held that position since 2003. But like many others, his research pivoted about a year ago to deal with COVID-19, and he has been one of the instrumental leaders in our institution in dealing with COVID-19. He is the principal investigator of the randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial of remdesivir at Montefiore, and he is the leader of the Montefiore-Einstein COVID-19 vaccine unit. So, Dr. Zingman, welcome, and thanks for joining us today.
Dr. Tomaselli, thank you so much for having me, and thanks everybody for joining the call and for your interest in this topic, as if we have anything else to talk about these days, it seems. So it's my pleasure to review some of what's gone on the last year and then begin to talk about the future as well and answer questions that you have in the time that we have available to us. So let me just talk back a little bit to February of 2020, when this epidemic was really largely unknown. We knew it was coming, but it was largely unknown in our experience in this country. And as part of my duties as the clinical director in ID at the Moses campus, I began to research new and potential options for therapeutics in getting ready for what was sure to be a wave of cases that was coming. And in my research, I had discovered about remdesivir at that point, probably being the most promising of the antiviral agents that was available. And right at the time when the first New Rochelle case occurred, and then I knew that we were going to be getting a lot of cases and it was just going to be starting them. Then I reached out to the NIH, found out that they were doing a trial of remdesivir that had started at two sites. And if you remember back then, the first sites, the first places in the country that dealt with COVID were in Washington State from some cases imported from China. And then in Nebraska from cases that came from cruise ships at the time. So at that moment, there were two sites in the country that were doing the remdesivir trial. And I contacted the lead investigator on a Sunday morning and told them what we were about to see and our interest in being involved in the remdesivir trial. And by the next day, we were named as a site on it. The first site to be named in New York City, and within 8 days we became an active site and enrolled our first patient, and it was an unbelievable whirlwind of events in that week. to prepare for this. And I have to say, you know, it was a tribute to many, many people in that first week that we were able to prepare. I would want to have a shout out to Dr. Tomaselli, because if you even remember this far back, it seems ages ago, you helped me out tremendously by providing upfront resources to be able to hire new staff in a week's time, and to be able to make sure that we would actually have the money and resources to be able to offer this trial. So thank you and the finance people and everybody else who helped us to actually get this, because that was absolutely critical. There were other sites around the country that tried to do this, and they couldn't get the resources. They didn't have the support. And so that was critical to this, as well as my own AIDS Center research team pivoted on a dime to moving from HIV-related trials to COVID trials. And we got volunteers from around Montefiore and Einstein whose investigators lent them to the effort. So it was amazing, and we had no idea at that moment how vigorous the surge would be, how we would become the epidemic, the center of the epidemic in the United States. We had no idea, but thank goodness for the planning that we had actually put in that week and 10 days before even knowing, and the resources that Einstein gave us to be prepared for it, because then we were ready. And we were one of only two sites in New York City that was in this first critical trial of the first antiviral agent for COVID-19. We didn't know it was going to work, but we knew that it was very promising. We were, for about 2 or 3 weeks, the only site in New York City that was offering remdesivir in this trial. And so that was an incredibly intense time in which people in which doctors, administrators, family members, patients from all over the tri-state area were contacting us to see whether or not they could get their patient or their family member or themselves into the trial and potentially be transferred to Montefiore for access to remdesivir. And this was even though they only had a 50% chance of getting the remdesivir. It was a placebo-controlled trial. We had basically hundreds of contacts, and we're getting referrals of dozens of patients every single day. And so, you know, we were very proud. We were one of 46 sites in the United States, one of 63 sites internationally. And this took place in five of the countries outside the United States as well. And in the end, because of the intensity of the epidemic in our area and because of the work of all the staff who are just incredible, enrolling patients in the study 7 days a week, we were the second highest enrolling site in the world. In the study, and the results came out very well. We were able to identify certain groups of patients with severe COVID-19 who clearly benefit from remdesivir treatment. Other groups that don't seem to benefit, or it's very still remains questionable whether or not they benefit. But certain groups that clearly benefit, including people on low doses of oxygen, whose mortality rate is lowered by 70% by being on remdesivir. So, and to show that no good deed goes unpunished, as we were the second highest enrolling site in the world on this study, the FDA gave us an intense audit, a week-long audit every single day, because our data was going to be key for the approval of remdesivir in the United States. Glad to say that we got through that with flying colors, and that was also helped along by NIH, who gave us a lot of technical assistance. So this was really a multi-tiered and multi-person, you know, effort to get the trial running, to get the results in quickly, to analyze the results, and then to get access to remdesivir for, you know, the world. I would say that since then, some other studies in other settings have not been as promising about remdesivir. But I do think that a significant part of that is the lack of supportive care in those areas. So at least in an area like ours, where there is good supportive care and ventilators when necessary, and antibiotics and anticoagulants, remdesivir can work significantly for a group of patients. And, you know, and this I would say, you know, helped to put Montefiore and Einstein on the COVID research map early on. And it was really wonderful to see. And it was a part of so many different developments that came out of Montefiore Einstein over the next few months, including the role of steroids in the treatment of COVID-19, anticoagulation in COVID-19, convalescent plasma, the use of monoclonal antibodies, various different immune modulators. Research came out here, research on testing for COVID-19. And then we've continued to do other trials since then. The second part of the remdesivir study was adding an immune modulator onto it, and then the third part was adding interferon onto remdesivir. And now we're in the midst of a study being led by Dr. Robert Grossberg at Montefiore Einstein, in which the steroid dexamethasone is being compared to the agent baricitinib to see which is actually better as an anti-inflammatory. So we've come, you know, a tremendous way in the management of people with severe COVID-19. We also, you know, during the last year, as everybody knows, have seen significant results with monoclonal antibodies against COVID-19 in people with less severe disease, people not hospitalized. And Priyanori is leading that program for monoclonal antibodies in outpatients with the Department of Medicine. And we've given monoclonal antibodies to outpatients to try to prevent them from developing severe disease, prevent them from developing hospitalization, given that to over 100 people so far. And that's been very successful. Some other developments, in, at least in the therapeutics, there really haven't. So developments in related treatment of diabetes as a complication, treatment of kidney disease as a complication. Treatment of the lung complications, we really come, you know, very, very far in how to treat severe COVID-19. And that's where the principal focus was, particularly at first, was on the patients who had the highest mortality and complications from COVID-19. One of the things we don't know yet that is going to be more interesting to find out over the next few months is to what extent do these treatments also prevent potentially the long-term complications of COVID. So this is something that has not been well studied yet. We know that some of the outcomes in the first few weeks are improved by remdesivir, by steroids, by other therapies, but to what extent do they also get rid of some of the lingering symptoms that have been very troubling to people with COVID-19? So I think my impression from the remdesivir patients from the ACT study was that my impression, but it wasn't being measured at the time. My impression was that people recovered to get back to themselves much better as well. But unfortunately, the study was not designed to follow that. And there were no good tools to follow that, those last lingering symptoms. Do they still have mild shortness of breath? Are they still limited? Are they still fatigued? Are they still having low-grade temperatures? That was not being followed. But my impression, because I actually did all the calls at 1 month of follow-up of the patients who got remdesivir or placebo, was that the people who had gotten remdesivir were feeling so much better so quickly. So I think that will be an outcome we'll see, but it has to be proven. And now, you know, my research and of course the focus of so much of our efforts around COVID-19 has moved towards vaccination. And as the dean mentioned, I've been, you know, honored to lead the COVID vaccine clinical trials unit, also sponsored by Montefiore and Einstein, and with an amazing amount of resources and trust that we would actually pull this off and do this well. And we have enroll patients into the AstraZeneca University of Oxford vaccine study. And as of today, we're up to about 190 patients enrolled in that study. And the enrollment in that study is closing today. So nationwide, about 30,000 people have been enrolled as of today. And then in about a month, we'll be starting the Merck vaccine study, which is also very promising. So I think in the interest of time, we should probably go on to questions because I could talk forever.
Yeah. So Barry, thanks. That's a terrific overview. We do have a number of questions about vaccination and about not so much the vaccine trials, but the existing vaccines. And perhaps you could address the mRNA vaccines that are out there now, what the rollout is in the Montefiore Health System, and whether or not these vaccines are protective in the sense that you're no longer able to carry virus, and can we start to behave like there's no more COVID around after you get vaccinated, or are there other precautions that we still should maintain even after being vaccinated?
Sure, absolutely, thanks. So let me say first, people frequently ask me, should I get this vaccine or which vaccine should I get? And my answer is, the best vaccine is the one you can get because they all look good. So the vaccines look good. They all the ones that are available are efficacious. All the ones that are available are very safe. They all look good. And in fact, there are no shortcuts being taken. The more vaccines are going to be approved based on very solid efficacy and safety. So the one you should get is the one you can get. Okay, so that said, it's the mRNA vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna that are the first ones available. They were the most easy to make, and so they were able to be studied first. Other ones took a little bit longer to make, so therefore they are a little bit later, by a couple of months later, like the AstraZeneca study. And these vaccines are overall very well tolerated, and they certainly work very well, at least in the short term that we know of so far. So you know, and I say it that way, you know, on purpose, that obviously the follow-up of people who've gotten these vaccines is short, 2-3 months on average. So we know they work very well for the first 2 or 3 months. It does remain to be seen over time, how well do they work at 6 months, a year, 5 years, 10 years? Do we need boosters? And in the end, are there other vaccines that might be better or not? We'll see. We'll see over time. Do they prevent transmission? Well, certainly they prevent disease. And if somebody gets COVID despite having the vaccine, it does appear that the disease is going to be less severe. Now, we can make a leap from that, that if you're less likely to develop COVID and less likely to develop severe COVID, then that would mean that you would have less virus that you are shedding from your body that could infect others. So it does seem extremely likely that the infectivity will also decrease once the vaccine is more widely being used. The Moderna vaccine has been shown to decrease viral loads in people who get COVID anyway. And so it seems extremely likely. And each of the other vaccines is being studied for the same thing. In every one of the vaccine studies, the viral loads are being measured if you do develop COVID. And so I'm very confident that in the next 2 or 3 months, we're going to have a lot more secure information on infectivity with the vaccines as well.
So there's another question about these variants or mutants that we've heard about first in England and now in this country. What makes them more transmissible, and is there a concern that the vaccines might not work against these variants?
Very good question. Thank you. So let me just step back for just 1 second on that question and make sure that at least people understand a little bit about what makes a germ work. What makes a germ either very, very feared or not feared at all. And it's a series of steps that the germ uses to get into us, cause disease, and then be transmitted. So from initial contact to binding and entry into our cells, to causing disease and how bad that disease is, to what is our immune response to it, how well are we able to control it or not control it? Is there an asymptomatic period when people have the infection and are spreading it but are not sick, or do they get sick very right away? And if they are sick, where do they shed it from? How much of that amount is there that they can actually spread it to others? Okay, so just given that introduction to what makes a pathogen, the new variants have a difference in the spike protein on the surface of the coronavirus that allows them to enter the cells more reliably. So they bind, so the SARS coronavirus, the spike protein binds to the ACE receptor. After that, it's able to enter the cells and then replicate. This variant, the two variants, South Africa and England, appear to increase the binding ability of that spike protein to bind to the ACE receptor and then enter. So it makes it, in effect, more transmissible because you're more likely to get virus into the person and into their cells, into the person. So that's what seems to be making it more transmissible. Now these are changes in the spike protein. These are changes in the spike protein that enable it to be a better binder to the receptor. So far, it appears that the antibodies and immune response that we would be producing to the spike protein from vaccination is not less effective with these variants. But there is that potential because our main immune response from the vaccination is against the binding site between the spike protein and the receptor. So if you do get enough variation, enough mutations in the binding site area, then potentially vaccines might be less effective, but that has not been demonstrated so far. So far, there is no evidence that the variant affects our ability to produce neutralizing antibodies and other immune responses against the virus.
Terrific. Another question that came up is about the logistics for distribution of the vaccine at Montefiore and in our community. Perhaps you can address that briefly.
So I'm not actually involved in the overall planning and of the vaccination effort at Montefiore. That is being handled by another group. Our CMO, our medical directors, this is a very, very big operation that they're trying to pull off to rapidly develop the staffing, the locations, acquire the supply, administer the vaccinations. So I really only know mainly what's out in the public largely, but I know that they are rapidly increasing the locations where the vaccine can be given, and I think also critically, it's being strongly kept in mind that we must be able to vaccinate the people who are most affected by this epidemic. We have to be able to offer the vaccine through Montefiore, and that's one of our specialties at Montefiore, is to engage communities of color and the Bronx community. We have to be able to get the vaccine to them, because if we don't get the vaccine to the communities most affected by COVID, we're not going to be successful at this. So, you know, if the only people we're getting the vaccine to are those of us who are staying in our home all the time and not going out, then that's not gonna help that much. It'll help us to feel better, but it's not gonna help the overall epidemic. We have to get it to everybody, and particularly those groups that are still getting a lot of COVID. And that's certainly part of Montefiore's strategy.
Yeah, thanks. I know that you are not the distribution hub. The distribution hub is at the health system. And I think the other thing to say is that we are pretty strictly following both federal as well as state guidelines for tiers of people who are going to get vaccinated and in what order. But ultimately, we want to vaccinate as much of the population as possible and those who anybody who wants to get vaccinated. So I would ask one final question about that. Can you explain to people who might have a little bit of reluctance to get vaccinated your kind of opinion about vaccines in general, and in particular this vaccine?
Absolutely. So I had a conversation. I parked my car at the Montefiore parking lot this morning, and there were two attendants working there, and one of them said to me, one is Hispanic, one is African American. One of them said to me proudly that he got vaccinated yesterday, and the other one said, "I'm not doing that." So I had a brief conversation, a brief intervention, a brief 1 minute intervention with the person who said he wasn't going to be taking it. And you know, his the first thing he said, well, let me say, there is so much mythology. There is so much misinformation that has to be a part of the education effort. So he said to me, "Can't you get COVID from the vaccine?" Oh my God. I said, no, you can't get COVID from the vaccine. And then he said to me, but he heard that a representative in the Bronx got the vaccine, but still got COVID. So what good is it? And I explained to him that as well, that no, it doesn't work for 100% of people, but it works for 95% of people. So we all have to get it. And then the other part is that, you know, we have to build trust. We have to reassure people that shortcuts have not been taken, which they have not. It's been done faster, but not done poorly. Much, much faster, but not poorly. The vaccines are very well studied. Now we are bringing them in soon into the community for sure. We're not waiting 5 years to find out the 5-year results of these vaccines like with some others. Absolutely, but that's because people would be dying otherwise. So we have to get these in quickly. But the results that we have right now are that the vaccines are extremely safe. The main thing that we don't know yet is how long they work for, how well they work over time. But we know they are extremely safe. And we know that they all work very well, at least in the first few months. And that's what we need to get through this terrible winter.
Well, Barry, thanks. That's incredibly helpful and I think incredibly important. And I would just say in closing that a lot of the support that the health system and the college were able to provide to your programs are a large thank you goes to many of the people on this call who've been supporters of Einstein and Montefiore, who made the resources available to support the research for acute treatment, as well as the role that we've played in vaccine development and vaccine deployment for this disease. And we're all hopeful that with the tools that we've developed and refined after we get through this winter, we're looking to a future with minimal to no COVID. So let me thank everybody for listening in today. Let me thank Dr. Zingman for an incredibly informative session and in conversation. And I hope you all have a great weekend.
Thank you so much, Dean.
Thank you.